This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For decades, critics have accused Hollywood movies of harboring a male bias, and the Me Too movement suggests that power imbalances really goes well beyond the screen. But in spite of that, many films have highlighted power of women. In the 1940s, some directors were willing to break stereotypes and cast women in the strong three-dimensional roles that they deserved. Today's Movies on the Radio is all about the leading ladies of cinema, and we're sitting down with our film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyes to talk about your favorite movies that feature unapologetically strong women. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University, Laura Boyes, film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art, and they join me in the studio now. Marcia, Laura, welcome back.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So this is, I mean, we have seen women in strong roles, really almost from the beginning, wouldn't you say, in Hollywood, one way or another?
Well, yes, it's absolutely true, but of course, men have been in charge of women's stories, so that's why it seems particularly rare when you get strong women characters that you can identify with 100%. You know, one of the women we're not going to be talking about is Ripley in Alien, and I could never get past the fact that she had to fight the monster in her underpants, you know, and that's something that a man, you know, that's what he wants to see.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's also interesting to take an opportunity to think about the fact that in the first couple of decades of film history, there were a lot of women who were directing and writing as well. They just got kind of pushed out by the time the studio system rose. And there's some interesting gems back in the early days, a film like Eleanor's Catch, that directed by Cleo Madison from around 1916, just a film about a woman. It sounds like it's going to be about a marriage, right? A woman getting a man, but she's an undercover agent who's got this job that she's got to do, and she ends up, you know, fighting. And at the end, it kind of goes back into a kind of conventional marriage ending. But there have been strong female characters that have popped up from the very beginning.
But the reason is that men realized there was money to be made in the movies, so they pushed the early women pioneers out so that they could take financial control of the industry.
And the stories, so even when women are strong, they're strong in a way that men are comfortable seeing them. And you talked about the studio system. It was well underway in 1940 when His Girl Friday was produced. Tell us
about
that.
So this was my pick for today. There are so many rich films from the 30s and 40s for this subject, but this was based on a play written by Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur called The Front Page. And in the play, it's about two newspapermen, one a reporter, one an editor. And so when Howard Hawks went about adapting this in 1940, he changed Hildy Johnson to a female reporter played by Rosalind Russell. And basically, she's left this super male newspaper world where she's had a divorce from Cary Grant, who plays her editor, Walter. And she's about to get married because she wants to have a normal life. And so the film is all about how Walter tries to subvert this.
Been seeing me in your dreams?
No, Mama doesn't dream about you anymore, Wally. You wouldn't know the old girl now.
Yes, I would. I'd know you anywhere.
You're repeating yourself, Walter. That's the speech you made the night you proposed.
Yeah, I know this. You still remember it.
Of course I remember it. If I didn't remember it, I wouldn't have divorced you.
Yes, I wish you hadn't done that, Hilly.
Done what?
Divorce me. Makes a fella lose all faith in himself. Almost gives him a feeling he wasn't wanted.
Oh, now, look, Junior, that's what divorces are for.
It's from His Girl Friday, a 1940 film with Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell.
So as you can hear from that, Hildy can hold her own. And I mean, not only is she great at banter and she can, you know, punch back at Walter verbally, you know, every time that he tries to lob one at her, but she's also this great reporter. And so Walter tries to seduce her back into the industry, and the journalistic industry. And by the end, he does succeed in winning her back. But over the course of this, it's just a great kind of modern film about family and career and this woman who can kind of duke it out in any context.
But of course, she's tried to talk herself into wanting what she thinks she should want, which is a boring Ralph Bellamy and a cozy cottage in upstate New York, you know, denying what her own impulses are to be part of the greater world.
Well, let's move ahead 5 years to the 1945 film Mildred Pierce.
My name is Ashley Bush from Durham, North Carolina, and the movie that I picked is Mildred Pierce. I chose Mildred Pierce because she's a woman who made a way for herself as a single mom at a time when working woman wasn't a thing. She kicked her cheating husband out of her home and decided to take matters into her own hands, as scary as that was for a woman at the time. And she went from cooking and baking as a talent in her waitressing to owning a multiple chain restaurant while under the scrutiny of her spoiled rotten daughter, who thought it was lower class for her to be working in the way that she did as an unmarried woman.
Why do you think I went to all this trouble? Why do you think I want money so badly?
All right, why?
Are you sure you want to know?
Yes.
Then I'll tell you. With this money, I can get away from you.
Vita.
From you and your chickens and your pies and your kitchens and everything that smells of grease. I can get away from this shack with its cheap furniture and this town and its dollar days and its women that wear uniforms and its men that wear overalls.
Vita, I think I'm really seeing you for the first time in my life, and you're cheap and horrible.
You think just because you made a little money you can get a new hairdo and some expensive clothes and turn yourself into a lady. But you can't, because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing. With this money, I can get away from every rotten, stinking thing that makes me think of this place or you.
1945 film Mildred Pierce with Joan Crawford being abused by her daughter. There's a twist.
Oh, her daughter is just so awful. This is like the flip side of Lady Bird, where there's no love in the arguing at all. This was made at a time when women were alone raising their children there. Men were off in World War II. Women were the main movie audience. And people like Joan Crawford and Betty Davis were the biggest stars because they were telling women's stories, and that's what they wanted to see.
Yeah, and as rotten as Vita is, the men in this film are more rotten.
Or even worse.
I mean, they are incapable, and they're double-crossing and lazy. And so it's very interesting. I mean, and the actresses, as Laura points out, like Crawford and also Katharine Hepburn, who were playing these kind of strong women who were holding their own. I think those are very important to this trajectory of telling stories about female characters that can hold their own, even if it's in the context of a film like this where the woman, I mean, she's so punished by her terrible daughter and all of these.
Well, but two viable options in a world dominated by men who are not about to let women get the upper hand, right? So one is to subvert. I mean, the money she's talking about is lying about being pregnant and sort of blackmailing this money out of a boy. Boyfriend. So this is a viable option in a world in which you have, right? I mean, so that's part of the genius of the film. I wonder how intentional that is. And also, if you make it out as a businesswoman, as the Joan Crawford character does, the fact is you've got the whole culture that is pulling you back. And so there's a way in which not everybody is going to come out of this in the same way that you did. Witness her daughter Vita, who says, "I don't want any part of that. I'm embarrassed by your
industry and your hardworking ethos."
And there's actually a more recent version of this with Kate Winslet that was an HBO miniseries, which is also excellent. And it really stresses more of the Depression era that the book was written in that gives it a slightly different trajectory.
Laura, your pick, Born Yesterday with Judy Holliday.
Yes, this is about a woman who comes with her boyfriend to Washington. He's planning on bribing a congressman to force some legislation through that will benefit his junk business. And he decides that her rough edges need to be smoothed, and he hires a tutor for her to teach her about American democracy.
Let's listen to this. Broderick Crawford is in this clip.
Yes.
And at a certain point, she decides that she wants out of this mess.
Yes, exactly, because she realizes that legislation is not for buying and selling, and that if you steal from the government, you're stealing from yourself.
Listen, cutie, don't get nervous just because you read a book. You're as dumb as you ever were.
You think so, huh?
Yeah, but I don't mind. You know why? Because you're the greatest...
Oh, leave me alone, Harry!
Come here!
No!
I never seen you like this.
I feel like I want to go away from.
Where?
I don't know.
Well, I'll wind up here in a couple of weeks. We'll go to Florida, maybe.
I mean, hello.
You know what I think? I think you're gone nuts.
Maybe.
All right, calm down.
I can't.
Why not?
I don't know. I just know I hate my life. There's a better kind. I know it. And if you read some of these books, you know it too. Maybe it's right what you say. I'm still dumb. But I know one thing I never knew before. There's a better kind of life than the one I got. Who are you?
That's from Born Yesterday, 1950, with Judy Holliday.
I watched this last week. This is such a perfect film for the Trump era. I'm so waiting for sexy William Holden to get Melania woke. It's just, it's amazing. And one of the things that I love about this whole film, for which she won an Oscar, beating out Bette Davis and All About Eve and Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard, is that she was, Judy Holliday was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and she testified in character as Billy Dawn, and the senators were so baffled by this that they completely let her off the hook, and she was never blacklisted because they were too stupid to realize that she was playing a character.
Well, and the dumb blonde character, I mean, that Jane Mansfield, Marilyn Monroe, that the characters that we see these women play are also, they can also be very subversive depending upon the context of the film that they're in, and this is a perfect example.
Right. One of my favorite lines in the film is that William Holden plays a reporter, and she steals some papers that he's going to publish in the newspaper, like the Pentagon Papers, and completely ruin her boyfriend. And she says, if there's a fire and I call the engine, who am I double-crossing? The fire?
It's Movies on the Radio today with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyce. That was pretty good. That was awfully good. We'll have you back. Actually, I'm going to confess this now. We don't get the clips from YouTube or anywhere. Marcia and Laura do all of the voices, right. And then we just add
it's
sound effects.
It's a lifetime of that's, movie watching that's, finally that's, paying off.
We are available
it's just
for
cheaper
for hire.
Than having to go through the whole movie. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio Broadcast Service at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Movies on the Radio continues after this. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Movies on the Radio today talking about your picks for the strongest women who have ever made it to the silver screen. I'm talking to Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyce. And let's move into the 1970s with a Jane Fonda film.
My name is Jackson Cooper. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my pick is Klute from the 1970s starring Jane Fonda. It's one of my favorite movies for a strong female character because Jane Fonda, who won an Oscar for playing this prostitute, brings so many layers to kind of the strong heroine character. And she's very much not just a powerful revenge seeker, but also deeply wounded and motivated by her own demons.
Well, I mean, I've been coming here all this time, and I've been paying you all this money, and why do I still want a trick? Why do I still walk by a phone and want to pick up the phone and call?
What's the difference between going out on a call as a model or as an actress or as a call girl? You're successful as a call girl. You're not successful.
Because when you're a call girl, you control it. That's why. Because someone wants you, not me. There are some Johns that I have regularly that want me, and that's terrific. But they want a woman, and I know I'm good. And you just lead them by the ring in their nose in the direction that they think they want to go in. And you get a lot of money out of them in as short a period of time as possible. And you control it, and you call the shots. And I always feel just great afterwards.
1971, Klute with Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland.
Well, I can say that within the academic world of film studies, Klute was such a big deal. For a long time, there were all these articles being written about it because it's a very unusual, explicit discussion about sex as work and this kind of Brie Daniel character played by Jane Fonda, that kind of combination of vulnerability and power, exploitation and being exploited, that's one thing that really stands out about this film, the way that it kind of address that very overtly in a way that hadn't been in films that were as popular as this before. Yeah.
And she seems like a regular person. I mean, you have, you know, a cliched idea of what a prostitute might be like, and you would think you wouldn't have that much that you would be able to discuss with them. But she brings this particular kind of occupation into a realm where you could see having a cup of coffee with her or, you know, having her be a member of your family or someone that you knew in college.
And
it's
this question,
different thing.
And this question of control over in a profession where you don't think the woman has much control and in an industry which, you know, in a world in which sex has become commodified, it may be the oldest profession, but it it has been commodified in this, in the modern times, in a way that, you know, we'd never seen. So the idea that a woman could take control of this, or even would have an aspiration to take control, was unique.
Well, there's a scene in it where she's having sex with one of her clients and she looks at her watch. And that's not something that, you know, you'd think of as part of that whole transaction.
Right. It's just another job.
Sally Field was a working girl, and she made it big in Norma Rae.
This is Diana Newton calling in from Carrboro, and my pick is the film Norma Rae, starring Sally Field as a textile worker. And she finds her way into becoming a union activist. And in the final culminating scene of the film, she hops up on a table in the mill.
Forget it! I'm staying put! Right where I am!
And in defiance of the factory floor supervisors and the sheriff and the sounds of the textile machines thwacking away, she does this slow revolving turn around the room, holding up the sign that just says, Union. And her coworkers stare at her and one by one start shutting down their machines. And you can see her trembling as she continues to defiantly hold the sign until the sheriff comes to get her.
Yes, police car, you're taking me to jail! No! No! No!
Put that strap in there!
No!
You're going with
me!
You're going to jail!
No! No!
Get over here!
But no matter, she has claimed her inner authority.
That's from the 1979 film Norma Rae.
Well, so this is a film that's actually based on a North Carolina woman, Crystal Lee Sutton, who was a textile worker and textile mill union organizer in North Carolina. And I was reading a contemporary from this time period interview with her, and she was actually a little disappointed that this film was played with such kind of singular heroism for the Sally Field character, because she really would have liked it to be much more about the collective and about
solidarity.
Exactly. Forever. As opposed to like that moment that's pointed to, which is so powerful and poetic in the film, but that it's all about, you know, this one woman as opposed to about the group and the larger effort.
And there are other films about working class heroines like Silkwood and Erin Brockovich, and they're all about women who are considered to be part of the underclass, not well educated and not able to speak up for their own agency or their own rights. And it's always very thrilling when they get a chance to do that.
Well, and that raises questions about a film like this, for instance, and when, where it fits in this discussion. Does it break the stereotype, or is it playing into a deeper stereotype, especially in the American consciousness, where it is the individual and that everything is the extraordinary individual? So there's no collective. So there's a working class hero story that we're fond of telling. And we can make it male, female, black, white, Latino, as long as it's an individual. But the minute you put everybody together in a room, that's when people start getting hurt.
Well, but movies are good at telling stories about individuals, right? I mean, that's where they excel, is by creating this relationship to a single person. So even if it's a disservice to the kind of historical record, or even to the kind of sentiment of thinking about a larger group of individuals, it's the more compelling way to tell a story. So there's a reason that we have these heroic figures, whether they're male or female.
Well, there are so few films in which people actually work. I mean, everybody has a profession. Oh, he's an architect. Oh, she's a this or a that. But you never actually see them working.
And it would this be pretty boring.
And this is a film that is soaked in what is actually like to work in the mill. And that also makes it unusual.
Not pretty boring. Marcia, you will know that the early film industry, before it became an actual industry, was working class films where people were going to the Nickelodeon, paying a nickel, watching films in Italian and German about their lives as workers, right?
Because there were people who couldn't afford the theater, afford the opera, or the symphony, the more classier entertainments. The movies were for the people.
For everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then when they became middle class, we had to change the story. Hey, here's one from 1980, which is well beyond the 19-teens. The film is Gloria.
Hi, this is Jim Carl. I'm the senior director of the Carolina Theater, and the film that I selected was John Cassavetes' Gloria from 1980. And why did I pick that film? Well, you have to remember the times. You know, I just lived through the 70s, and tough female characters were few and far between, if any. I mean, in those days, Sally Field was starring in Norma Rae, Jane Fonda was doing China Syndrome, and Jamie Lee Curtis was in Halloween, and these were all strong female characters, no argument here. They weren't, however, tough characters, and that's the difference. And by tough, I mean like Charles Bronson and Steve McQueen tough. There were just no tough female characters that felt like in the 1970s, not until Gloria came along. Women were damsels in distress, mothers, wives, or victims. They could be strong, supportive, loving, and many things, but they were never tough. And Gloria, she was a tough broad who could fire a handgun and not get a single hair out of the process.
Gloria, why don't you take a walk? We'll take care of that kid. You got that book, kid? Come here.
Hey, Frank. What are you gonna do? Shoot a 6-year-old Puerto Rican kid on the street? You don't know nothing. He don't even speak English.
And that is Gloria firing the shots, just in case you were wondering, 1980.
I love this pick. I mean, first off, this is John Cassavetes is the director of this film, and that's Jenna Rollins. And Cassavetes did not make conventional movies to start off with. And this one, in some ways, is almost more conventional than his average film. But, I mean, she is so totally tough. She's unsentimental. She's so streetwise. And this film is so full of unconventional things and surprises. It's really, really a great example of something that is completely original in terms of its imagining of a female character. And even though there are other, I think, examples of kind of tough characters, Laura brought up Ripley in Alien, which is from 79, that kind of predate this. This is a really different kind of thing because that's set in this otherworldly right. situation. This is set in New York City, in the contemporary world, and it's a woman basically taking on all of these mobsters and, you know, winning in the end.
Well, it's also she's taking care of a child, and it's a movie that acknowledges maternal instinct can also be a power. It's so often denigrated that having children and caring about them is a weakness and not a strength.
And for her in this film, it's also not, it's something that she has to come to. It's not that she has, I mean, she says, I hate kids. I hate this kid in particular. And she has to come to understand that he's worth protecting.
My name is Charlotte. I am from Durham, North Carolina, and I chose The Silence of the Lambs. It's my favorite movie. I wrote about it in my college application essays. And Clarice Starling, or at least the Jodie Foster version of her, is really petite. And that I think that was used to great advantage in the movie. There's one shot of her in a crowded elevator surrounded by just hulking giants of men who tower over her. And she looks tiny and insignificant and a little scared. And that's one thing that I really appreciate about her is that she's not a rock.
What is your worst memory of childhood?
Death of my father.
Tell me about it and don't lie, or I'll know.
He was a town marshal, and one night he surprised two burglars coming out of the back of a drugstore. They shot him.
Was he killed outright?
No, he was very strong. He lasted more than a month. My mother died when I was very young, so my father had become the whole world to me, and when he left me, I had nothing. I was 10 years old.
From the 1991 film The Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, so this is a great pick. And Jodie Foster, you know, it's interesting to hear these actresses that have come up from the beginning of the show who are associated with these kind of tough, spirited, assertive roles. And I think she's certainly one of them, that she's this kind of token woman in this very male universe. And she blends, like so many of these other characters we've been talking about, this kind of vulnerability, but also this assertiveness, this toughness. And it's not that she's completely unafraid, but she's always moving forward. And I think for a lot of women watching that film, that was a pretty powerful iconography.
Well, people really love this movie, but I have enough nightmares without watching it.
It was a good film. Just trust us. It's one of the few I've
seen. She's going to have to.
I'm happy to acknowledge anyone's love of any movie, but that doesn't mean I have to watch it.
Well, let's move on.
Hi, I'm Samantha Shepherd, and I am calling from Ithaca. And the movie that I selected was Julie Dash's 1991 masterpiece, Daughters of the Dust. And the reason why I've chosen this as an example of really sort of strong, great, fantastic, wonderful women is because it's made by a really strong, great, fantastic, and wonderful Black female filmmaker, Julie Dash. And it tries to give you sort of this Black womanist perspective on sort of generational changes.
Eli, we carry these memories inside of we. Do you believe that those hundreds of Africans brought here on this other side will forget everything they once knew? We don't know where the recollection comes from. Sometimes we dream them, but we carry these memories inside of we.
What are we supposed to remember, Nana? How we one time was able to protect those we love? On the Africa where we were kings and queens and built great big cities?
Eli, I'm trying to learn you how to touch your own spirit. I'm fighting for my life, and I'm fighting for yourn.
Julie Dash really knows how to light women so that all the different hues of Blackness come in fully rendered, and the characters themselves are really sort of galvanizing each other, other women galvanizing other women to be able to appreciate themselves, to love each other, and to really be there for their families.
Talking about the 1991 film Daughters of the Dust.
This is an incredibly beautiful and interesting film. First off, this is the only really independent film that I think we'll be talking about today, made completely outside of the Hollywood system. This film was just restored and has just been playing in New York and other places. If you have a chance to see it, I would highly recommend it. And what's so exceptional about it is it's telling such a different story, right? It's outside of the norms of just everything we've been talking about, very plotted, singular character-driven. This is about a collective. It's about a family at this time of change. It's about history. It's about women and women's role in the family and these women who voice the story. It's a tremendous example for today.
It has a very dreamlike atmosphere that really draws you in. And it's hopeful, but at the same time, there's this underlying feeling of dread because they're all getting ready to move up north where the opportunities are going to be greater, but they're stepping out of paradise, essentially. So you feel happy and sad and worried for everyone at the same time.
Well, and what about Samantha's point that this is a Black director who understands the craft and how it's going to play when you're lighting and shooting African-American characters?
Absolutely.
Right? And actors.
And this is her only feature film, is that correct?
That's correct. That is correct.
We will move on to 1996 with our next pick.
Hi, I'm Russell from Cary. I chose Gina Davis in the movie The Long Kiss Goodnight. Gina Davis has played a lot of strong women over the course of her career. She was great in Thelma and Louise and A League of Their Own, both really strong characters. And later she even portrayed the President of the United States on the short-lived TV series Commander-in-Chief. But it was her turn as the amnesiac housewife assassin in 1996, The Long Kiss Goodnight, that really stands out for me. This is one of the first times I remember seeing a female lead in an action movie that I really bought. So in this movie, Gina Davis plays a mom and a school teacher who has amnesia. She's just a woman, no exoskeleton, no knowledge of the future, and she still kicks butt.
Why don't you just go away and come back at midnight? Shoo. Hey, honey.
This is a real big gun.
This ain't no ham on rap, pal.
What the hell are you doing?
Saving your life. I would have been here sooner, but I was thinking up that ham on rye line.
You think I can't take him? Well, you probably scared the other ones away.
What up?
Headhunters, Nimrod. They don't travel alone. You always this stupid? Or did you take lessons?
I took lessons. Hey!
What?
I still got this f***ing gun.
Here.
What really seals the deal for me, though, is a line from her co-star, Sam Jackson. When they're both captured by the bad guys, he says, "I'll be waiting for you to come and rescue me," and you buy every bit of it.
Talking about the 1996 film, The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Well, I've never heard of this movie before, and I can't wait to put it on my Netflix queue. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, I have not heard of it, nor have I seen it. But, you know, Gina Davis is an interesting example in terms of this thinking about actresses who play these roles, because she had been in Thelma and Louise in 1991, which is a film that many people were talking about at the time in terms of its relationship to kind of this feminist independence versus this kind of male reliance. And so she's clearly one of the actresses who's on this list of strong female performers.
And she's been very active in getting women behind the camera as well.
Yes, and recently been doing a lot to talk about this stuff in relationship to Me Too as well. Mm-hmm.
Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys, Movies on the Radio, your favorite films with strong female characters. More clips, more talk, more movies after this. This is The State of Things, Movies on the Radio today, talking about listener favorites with unapologetically strong female characters. Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys are with me, and our listeners as well.
My name is Lynn Taylor. I'm from Raleigh, and my favorite movie pick is Kill Bill. I think I actually like Kill Bill 2 better than Kill Bill 1, because you get the background of the story. Kill Bill 1 is a very violent movie. But when I think about why Uma Thurman was so violent, I think if somebody messed with my baby, that I might be similarly violent.
You and I have unfinished business.
Baby, you ain't kidding.
Really helps me when I get very angry about a situation and think about, how should I handle this? I do think about, am I that mad, and would I handle it that violently? The movie really is incredibly over-the-top violent. And actually, it was my children, my young adult children, or maybe they were teenagers at the time, children who introduced me to the movie, both daughters. And it's, none of us are really violent people, but it's helpful to think about how to deal with situations.
2004 film Kill Bill. And this is exactly how it helped me, because now when I get angry, I take a deep breath and plunge my fist into the chest of the person who made me angry.
Well since this is a Miramax movie, Uma Thurman may have been channeling some of that anger
She was. Well, this is a film we would have been talking about differently a year ago, because it was fairly recently the New York Times ran a story in which Uma Thurman finally talked about what happened to her during the making of this film. And I would urge you to look at that article in the New York Times about how Quentin Tarantino bullied her into driving this stunt car that she was not comfortable with. And she got severely injured during the shoot. And she's one of the victims of the Weinstein universe. And she has finally been speaking about this. And she talks about the fact that this is a film about female empowerment and how ironic it is that she was part of this universe that basically she talks about lambs being led to slaughter in the Harvey Weinstein world, and that she is, you know, one of the women who was part of this universe, and how devastating this experience was making this movie for her.
It's an exploitation movie in so many senses.
Yes, that's right.
Would it have been seen that way without this context?
No.
I mean, because in some ways when the woman does get to plunge her fist through the chest of the man who did all those things.
Well, because exploitation movies actually have a history of having, you know, these kick-ass female heroines, all the blaxploitation heroines,
Cleopatra Jones and
Coffee and all of these people, so that it was playing into a tradition that Quentin Tarantino really admired.
Was it, is this sort of Cotton Comes to Harlem, you know, the next generation in that way? I mean, in the sense that it presages maybe an ultimate, maybe a real change, that you have to have the fantasy, right? The revenge fantasy, and then maybe things start to change.
Although I think this is Tarantino's revenge fantasy that he plays out with these characters. And unfortunately, in this case, it ended up literally hurting the actress.
Let's move on.
Hi, this is Kim Allen. I live in the Chapel Hill area, and I am nominating the movie Serenity. Serenity is a movie that came out of Joss Whedon's TV show Firefly. Basically, it's a Western in space. We have the ragtag bunch of outsiders who are trying to survive while steering clear of the Alliance, which is the government. Unfortunately, the Alliance is very much making a point of trying to hunt them all down, and this movie is explaining why that is. The reason I chose this movie is because there's so many very strong women. There's Zoe. She's a former soldier who fought side by side with our captain. She's tall, she's strong, and she can kick anyone's butt. There is Inara, who is a companion. That's a high-level courtesan, but she's not just eye candy. She's really smart, she's savvy, and she can fight with the best of them. Kaylee is the heart of the crew. She's a good and very kind, sweet person, but she's not useless. She's a mechanic, and she's the one who keeps Serenity, their ship, in the air. Lastly, there's River. A lot of this movie is River's story. She is a genius who's basically had her mind pulled apart by the Alliance. And in Serenity, we discover what's been done to her and why the Alliance wants to wipe them all out.
I'm taking your sister under my protection here.
She's conditioned for combat. She's a creature of extraordinary grace.
The only people she's a threat to is us on this boat.
River, do you want to stay with them?
It isn't safe for them.
All the women in here are strong. They all fight. They're just really well-written female characters.
Based on the 2005 or the 2005 film Serenity, based on the TV series Firefly.
Well, Joss Whedon, of course, likes strong female characters like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And Firefly and Serenity are kind of a fusion of the Old West, a real space opera. But all of these strong female characters have to come back to Lieutenant Uhura, I think, on Star Trek. Mm. That was the beginning of seeing a woman in outer space who could hold her own.
Let's move on to our next film. This is a female character, strong female character of a slightly different type. Let's listen.
My name is Donnie Kay, and I live in Raleigh. And I chose the movie with a strong female character that I've always loved as was Winter's Bone. It starred Jennifer Lawrence, and I think it might have been her first role. She was a teenager at the time. I had read the book by Daniel Woodrell, which was brilliant, and I was not disappointed. I thought they absolutely nailed it with this depiction of life in the Ozarks. The setup of the story is she's a teenager who's basically taking care of her little brother and little sister because her mother is mentally ill or out of it, and her father has skipped town. He's a meth. He cooks meth, and he's skipped town on his. He said put their house up for bond, and the sheriff comes and tells her, "You've got 1 week to find your father, or your whole family is out on the street." And the people who live in that area in Ozarks are all, you don't talk to the law. It's like a code of silence.
You got something to say, child? You best say it now.
I got two kids that can't feed themselves yet. My mom's sick, and she's always gonna be sick. Pretty soon the laws are coming and taking our house and throwing us out to live in the field like dogs. If Dad has done wrong, Dad has paid. And whoever killed him, I don't need to know all that. But I can't forever carry them kids and my mom. Not without that house.
It was from the 2010 film Winter's Bone, today on Movies on the Radio.
Yeah, I want to point out this is written and directed by Deborah Granick, so it's a woman behind the camera and who wrote the script as well. And this is a killer performance for Jennifer Lawrence. And I think that idea of a young woman who's having to keep her family together and having to stand up to some pretty intimidating characters. It's not an over-dramatized film. It's very sensitive, I think, in terms of what it does. And this is a killer role.
I think it's worth asking why so many women directors choose such bleak subjects.
Well, I mean, I think that they are telling stories that aren't being told in other contexts. I think that's part of it, is that the history of representation is so often, you know, these kind of outlandish characters that they're looking in the world and looking for to tell, you know, different kinds of stories and filling gaps. That's my perspective.
And the other untold story here, not well enough told story, is that rural America left behind and the level of violence and abuse that has characterized you know, with, in this case, meth addiction, you know, that's the story we don't hear as often. If we hear about violence, it tends to be urban violence. And now we're looking at the undertold story about the level of violence and substance abuse in rural America and the toll it's taking. And so that was also, I think, an important part of this and an important character in this movie.
Well, it's the propaganda that all drug use is an urban phenomenon.
Well, the Western has long been the bastion of the man. That's where, you know, men cut their teeth and told the story of America in a certain way. Meek's Cutoff makes an effort to turn that around a bit.
My name is David Bellerath, and I'm calling from Durham. And my pick for this category is Meek's Cutoff. It is a Western that came out in 2010, and it's by a filmmaker, a female filmmaker that I like quite a bit. Her name is Kelly Reichardt. As a fan of Westerns, and particularly John Ford Westerns, I was really pleased that Kelly Reichardt chose to make a Western. Just as John Ford returned to John Wayne again and again in his films, Kelly Reichardt in her films has settled on Michelle Williams as her go-to actress. And in Meek's Cutoff, Michelle Williams plays a member of a wagon train, and it's based on a true story. Something happened in the Oregon Territory, I believe in the 1840s, and Michelle Williams' character emerges during a time of great struggle with this wagon train. She emerges as a leader and helps pull the demoralized wagon train together.
Sometimes I get the sense you don't care for me much, Miss Tetherell.
Oh, I have no feelings one way or the other, Mr. Meek.
That's just a kind way of saying you don't like me.
I don't like where we are.
So that's what you think, that we're lost?
I'd say that seems about the right word for it.
We're not lost. We're not lost. We're just finding our way.
I certainly hope so.
We're gonna make it all right.
Oh, you don't need to patronize me, Mr. Meek.
Well, now, I think you're flirting with me, ma'am.
You don't know much about women, do you, Stephen Meek?
Meek's Cutoff, directed by Kelly Reichardt.
In some ways, I think this film shares more with Daughters of the Dust in terms of its kind of patience. This is not a traditional Western by any stretch of the imagination. And Reichardt most recently did a film called Certain Women in 2016, which I think was not seen by many people. That's also very focused on these kind of slow stories of women's lives, that nothing too dramatic happens. And in some ways, Meek's Cutoff is a kind of Western version of that. And let me just add that there's a couple of important Western precedents with female characters. Barbara Stanwyck in 40 Guns, the Sam Fuller film, Joan Crawford in Johnny Guitar, one of my favorite Westerns of all time by Nicholas Ray. So it's kind of interesting to place a woman at the center of a narrative in which it's unlike those films, which are rewriting the genre but using all of the conventions. This one is doing something very different.
Well, in a traditional Western, you know, there's the school marm or the prostitute as your two choices for characters. But if you read the journals of the women who went out West, they're filled with such horrible loneliness and such self-sufficiency because men often left them behind for long periods of time, and they were really forced to be resourceful. And I really do wish to see more of those women's Western stories.
Well, it would be good because it would tell the other side of the story. The way we tell it now is these brave pioneers, you know, weathered all kinds of hardship in order to make a better life. But it's really greedy men trying to get much more than they needed, breaking the family ties, breaking the connections that they had that are domestic connections that actually keep us together, because they didn't care. There was another tree to cut down. We never tell that part of the story, and it would be nice to get that in.
Well, there's this one journal where this woman talks. She's living alone in a sod house in the wintertime, and she goes out and lays with the sheep just to have some company because she's so incredibly lonely out on the prairie.
Our next film, the most recent film. This one, of course, you will recognize.
Hi, my name is Jeremiah Rosen. I'm calling from Durham, and the movie I chose was Black Panther. And the reason I chose that was because it managed to offer a number of really well-rounded characters that were given a lot of opportunities to share their opinions and have deep relationships with each other. And I think that they all interact with T'Challa, the main character, really well, and they establish that he respects their opinions, and he realizes that in order to be a successful king, he needs to take in all opinions, especially these women that are close to him.
We are home.
My son, it is your time.
Show me my respect and bow down.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be. Don't freeze.
I never freeze.
They carry a large brunt of the movie when T'Challa is actually absent for probably like 25 minutes at the end, and this falls to them, and they're allowed to drive the story forward with their opinions, and they are crucial for the story wrapping up the way it does.
Talking about this year's blockbuster, Black Panther.
Well, T'Challa is a king of a matriarchy, which is really very interesting, I think.
I would love, I mean, I've seen the film once and I plan to see it again. I would love to literally count the lines by male and female characters in this film, because I think the women come out pretty good all told.
Definitely passes the Bechdel test.
Yes, definitely passes that test. But I mean, there are female warriors, they're innovators, they're inventors. I love the little sister character. She's probably
so
my favorite, who's like the scientist, innovator, inventor, who comes up with all the cool stuff and looks really awesome in the process, too.
Well, I also love the fact that technological worlds are always envisioned as being very sleek and shiny. And this is a futuristic world with lots of surface decoration, which mm-hmm. itself is seen maybe as a feminine attribute, that everything is covered with pattern and color, and it just kind of sizzles off the screen.
Yeah, and I think there's a dimensionality to a lot of the female characters in this film that we haven't seen so much in, certainly in the superhero films, maybe Wonder Woman being the exception because it's focused on a female character. But they have a real presence in the story, they have a reason to be there, and they are useful to the kind of narrative at hand as opposed to kind of being more sidelined.
Yeah, and even though the superhero is a solo superhero and a phenomenon, the collective is very important. It does play a little more important role in this.
Well, it takes a village. I mean, it takes it quite literally that he needs his whole community around him in order to do good.
Okay, next time, what do you say we talk about movies that are overrated, films that you think should never have gotten the press or the critiques, the glowing
reviews.
Or the awards.
Can you see me rubbing my hands together in glee?
We can tee off on these and finally tell them what we really think. And you can tell us what you think. Films that you think are highly overrated, shouldn't have gotten the award, who criticized that, what kind of review was that? SOT@WNC.org, that's the email address. #SOTMovie, and we're going to talk about your picks, films that you think are overrated. Oh, I can see the wheels turning right now. Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
See you later.
Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State. Laura is the film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art, and you can find links to the films at our website, stateofthings.org, a program that's produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Robert Kinlaw, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.